Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison. You are listening to the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio is Dr. Marco Cavaglia. He's a professor of physics at Missouri S&T in Rolla, Missouri. Thanks for stopping by, Marco.
Thank you.
Marco, you work on LIGO, which is the Laser Interferometric Gravitational Wave Observatory, a collaboration between many different physicists and institutions. And so tell us a little bit about the different pieces to that as a broad thing and which role your group plays in that project.
Yes, so the LIGO, how we call it, is a very large collaboration of people. And right now we are over 1,200 people in 100 institutions all across the world in more than 20 countries. And there are, in our collaboration, researchers of different expertise and background, from engineers, technicians, to theoretical astrophysicists, and all what you can have in between, like computer scientists.
I mean, when you think about the scale of this, this is a 30-year-long project driven by a few people who won the Nobel Prize, and it's basically a gigantic interferometer. For those people who don't understand that, it's essentially two beam paths through which a laser propagates, and you get some sort of an interference effect between the paths. And because of the way they're set up, they can respond to changes or distortions in their lengths slash their shapes. So talk about how you got drug into this, how you became a part of it, because you're a theorist, I think. So you didn't play much of a role in building the beast. Talk about how you got involved and what kind of a role you play.
Yeah, that's right. So my background is in theory, theoretical physics and astrophysics. So I joined the experiment over 12 years ago to contribute to the interpretation of the astrophysical signals that we found with the detectors. Of course, building the detectors, running them, and make them functional and sensitive enough to detect these signals is a huge enterprise. Some of my colleagues say that it takes a village now to do this kind of physics. So when you mention people who got the Nobel Prize, they started 30, 40 years ago this big project, but then it got expanded, and there are many people that contribute to different aspects. So physics nowadays, this large-scale physics, is very different from what we were doing 100 years ago in a lab.
Yeah, on a high-energy paper or something related to this, there can be hundreds of authors that are actually listed, usually alphabetically, on the paper that might be published. It's something similar on this, is it not?
Yes, I have. I think I have a paper with 4,000 co-authors.
Wow.
This was the paper when we discovered the first collision between two neutron stars in 2017, and we found the gravitational wave signal in LIGO. But then the event was followed up by astronomers all around the world. So I have a paper with 4,000 co-authors. Essentially, most of the astrophysicists and telescopes.
That's going to help your vita with your citations, I'm guessing.
That's right. On the other hand, you have to divide the number of citations by 1,000.
Oh, yes, you have to divide them. So. That's true. So when you do the simulations you do, this kind of a detector, so to speak, isn't something that just sits in a room, and there's a lot of things that go into it. There's a lot of noise. And so a signal comes out. And when a signal comes out, exactly what must be done to take that signal and decide if it's meaningful, and then decide what it means?
So this we have two of these detectors in the U.S.
That's important, is it not?
Yeah, one is in Louisiana and one is in Washington State. And the reason why we have two detectors is because we want to make sure that the signal we see comes from space. So both of them should record the same signal at the essentially the same time with the same characteristics. But nevertheless, these are very sensitive instruments. So what we try to detect is very small vibration, very small changes in length of these instruments that are miles long. And in order to do that, we have to really dig into the data, into the what we call the noise, so the statics of the of that is produced by the instruments, and try to detect small wiggles, right, that of that are buried in this, in all this static.
Now, this must be some sort of a mathematical technique. So are you using some sort of a correlation function of some kind or another where you're trying to look at the signal and make sure that the things you're seeing actually tune in somehow? Talk a little bit about whether it's a numerical technique or whether it's a paper and pencil theoretical technique.
Yeah, so it's a numerical technique. It's a signal processing technique that is being used in engineering and many other fields. It's called match filtering. So what we do is that the theory tells us what kind of signal we should expect. And then we try to match that theoretical prediction to the actual data that come out of the instrument. And it's very similar to, you know, when you try to tune on your radio. At first you hear a lot of statics, but then you know that you want to hear words. You know those, you know, how words sound in advance. And so what you do, you turn your knob until you start hearing some words, and that's exactly match filtering. So you try to match what you expect with what you see in the data.
Does that mean that effectively, because most people think of a signal and they think, I'm watching this detector and all of a sudden I see it light up, as it were. I see a blip or I see a clearly evident thing. But it sounds to me like you need to let the thing just gather data and then later go look for the signals in it. Is that true? You're not going to be able to look at it and say, oh, signal, right?
That's true. So these are like antennas, right? So they, when they are on, they capture data all the time. And then we look at the data that are coming live, or we can look at the data after we have collected them and try to see if there is something in it.
Right. Now, talk about one of the signals. So the first thing you detected, I think you told me, was what, the collision of two black holes, right?
Yeah, that was in 2015. And the first signal we saw was the collision of these two huge black holes.
Okay, and so how long, what period of time would the signal, as it were, register inside the detector? Are we talking microseconds? Are we talking longer than that?
I mean, it depends how massive, how big these objects are. But for example, for black holes that are have a mass of a few tenths of the mass of the sun, the signal is usually last about a few seconds.
Okay. And so what's different? So the first thing you detected was the collision of two black holes. And what was the next major discovery? Talk about that. And then talk about the difference between the two signals. Is it a difference in intensity, or is there some sort of a time characteristic difference? Or talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the second major discovery was in 2017, and we found out a collision between two neutron stars. And so neutron stars are stars that form at the end of the life of normal stars. They are very compact. So they have just a radius of a few miles, but their mass is bigger than the mass of the sun. So they are really very compact. And when they collide, there is a lot of matter involved. They emit also some radiation, some light. So this event can be seen with gravitational waves, but can be seen also by optical telescopes. And that's what happens in 2017. So we first captured the signal, and then we alerted the astronomers to look at a particular direction of the sky. And then with their telescopes, they saw the afterglow, the light that came out of the event. And it's a very different signal because it's much longer.
So this, which one's longer?
The neutron star collision signal is longer than a black hole collision, because the two stars are smaller than black holes,
right.
So they can get closer. So they spend more time orbiting around before the collision. So we can see the signal, which is longer.
When you model this, because you get this signal, And then to decide what it is, you can't just look at that and say, oh, that squiggle that I somehow sucked out of the data, that's this. So you have to model it. So talk about the process by which you model it. What do you start with? Do you start with the field equations, the gravitational field equations, or how do you start that kind of a modeling process?
Yes. So these we use the equations, the Einstein equations of general relativity.
Right.
And essentially, we solve them for these cases of colliding black holes or colliding stars. Of course, Einstein equations are very elegant equations. They are very simple to write down, but they are very difficult to solve exactly. So nowadays, there is a lot of research that goes into solving this equation using supercomputers. So we use, we write down these equations and then we solve them numerically. And it may take weeks or even months to find a single solution that then we can try to match with the data.
Let me just ask, I remember there was this whole thing where there was this big discrepancy with this black hole thing and the people that argued about all this code that was written. And so do you have different groups, parallel effort, so that they make sure that they don't come to the same conclusion because they work together all the time? I mean, are you asking different groups to look at this and get the same solution, or how does that work?
We do, and there are several groups in the U.S. and in other countries that do that kind of work, and so they can compare their results. And that's not only true for, you know, the theoretical work, but also for the experimental work. For example, in LIGO, we have two detectors, but we partner with a third detector that is in Europe. So we can exchange data and we can make sure that what we see is really what
right.
comes from space.
So now that you've got these functioning detectors, which amazingly enough seem to be able to detect gravitational waves, I mean, everybody sort of, this was one of those things, everybody figured that sooner or later, we would detect gravitational waves. It didn't ever seem to be a question of that. It was merely a question of, is this doable technologically? Now you've got these things. And so what are they in the process of doing right now? What kinds of things are going on?
So there are still many things that we want to find out and discover. For example, we just discovered in the past few years that there are a lot of black holes in the universe. And these black holes can actually collide and merge and create larger black holes within the time frame of the universe. So we want to find out how many there are, what kind of population of black holes there is in the universe, how they form, and also at the same time we want to do some fundamental physics. So we want to test Einstein theory of general relativity in a very precise way to see if you know, it must be corrected at a certain point.
Just out of curiosity, so when I think about black holes, what I've been taught, and I'm not an astronomer at all, is that, oh gee, pretty much at the center of every galaxy, there's probably a black hole. So if these black holes are colliding, are you talking about galactic collisions, or are you talking about rogue black holes that are wandering around by themselves?
That's an interesting question. It's a question we try to answer. We know that there are very massive black holes at the center of galaxies, and these are black holes with millions of solar masses. We also know that there are small black holes as small or as big as the Sun. What we don't know is if large black holes, massive black holes, form by merging smaller black holes.
Oh, that would be interesting.
Or if they are primordial black holes that were created at the beginning of the universe. We don't know if these black holes, when they collide, is because they simply meet in space, or if they evolve together like two stars orbiting one around the other. These are very interesting questions that we don't know how to answer.
So you're essentially saying that this research is opening up for the cosmologists whole other avenues of study for them.
That's right. And the fascination with this physics is that we can look at the very small things, at the microscopic world. So we can test, for example, the real essence of space-time, and at the same time we can look at the large-scale structure of the universe and try to understand what is dark matter and all what is in between. So it's really a branch of physics that connects the infinitesimally small with the infinitely big the universe.
Well, Marco, I'm sorry, but I think we're out of time. Thanks so much for stopping by today.
Thank you very much.
And this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.